This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Tung Nguyen. I'm a physician who work in the University of California, San Francisco. I also do research on public health, health disparities, using what we call community-engaged research methods. Most of my work is with Asian American populations, and I actually started out doing Vietnamese American health work. I am also a policy person. I have started two nonprofit organizations. One is called AAPI Victory Alliance, and the other is PIVOT, the Progressive Vietnamese American Association.
Welcome to the Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you, Anh Tung. It's a pleasure and honor to have you on the podcast. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
So I will say that I don't know what it means to be Vietnamese, but I think I have some ideas what it means to be Vietnamese American. I struggle with my identity, whether I was Vietnamese or Vietnamese American or American, most through my teenage and young adult years. And I remember the moment when I realized that I wasn't Vietnamese and that I was Vietnamese American. That was when I went back to Vietnam in 1993. And I realized that the people there didn't think I was all that Vietnamese. I didn't feel like I was Vietnamese there. And then when I came back to the United States, I was pretty much settled in my identity as a Vietnamese American. Now, what does it mean to be a Vietnamese American? I think that definition is going to change with which generation you're from. But I think the biggest thing that means to be Vietnamese American, number one, is that our origin is rooted in war and being a refugee and being in resettlement. So trauma, we have to understand that that's part of our identity, whether or not you went to it directly or secondhand through your parents or grandparents. Second, it's the ability, and I think this is a good thing, to straddle two worlds. I think a lot of time when I was growing up, was like, oh, I really want to have an identity. And now I'm like, actually, it's good to have multiple identities. And even when they don't mesh, I don't care. I mean, I love it. I love having different points of view. I love being able to criticize myself. Here's what a white American person would think like, and I think like that. And then, oh no, that's no good. Now this is what a Vietnamese person would think like, and I think like that. So the duality of it. My brother Viet Nguyen, who wrote The Sympathizer, had different approaches to the concept, but the whole underlying root for The Sympathizer was this is a person from two different places and trying to reconcile those two identity, and he does it in a literary way. I do it in a more, I major in philosophy in college, so I think about it more in terms of the philosophical underlying principles, but also as a physician too, I think about it in terms of that. So what it means to be Vietnamese American is that you get the best of both worlds. How's that?
Thank you for that. Did you and Viet ever discuss this identity as you were both growing up?
No, he and I had a very large gap when we were growing up. I was, I think, 6 years older than he was. So when I was a teenager, he was, in elementary school. And by the time he became old enough to talk about these things, I was away either at college or medical school. And then he went away to college. So we never really sat down and talked about it. And even now when we do sometimes approach it, we come at it from different angles. But I think for me, the struggle was, I was Vietnamese, how do I become Vietnamese American? And I think for him, I think he started out because he was so much younger, started out being, American, English speaking American. And then he spent a lot of his young adult years reconnecting with his Vietnameseness, and I think he's done a great job of it. But I think we came at it from very different angles.
Right. And how old were you when you arrived in the U.S.?
I was 10.
And what was it like as a 10-year-old?
So we came, we left in the end of April 1975. We were out on a barge, and then it ended up in on a ship, and then we went to Manila, and then we went to Guam. And then by, I think, August of 75, we were we were in the refugee camp in Pennsylvania, which is in Fort Indiantown Gap. Spent a few months there, and then we were then sponsored out of the camp by white families. It turns out that they were trying to do something what I thought was very nice, which is that to take the kids away from the parents so that the parents can learn how to make a living. But it doesn't feel like that in retrospect, because I was 10 and I couldn't be with my parents, and I had to go live in a white family. And Viet was even worse. He had to go live in a family when he was 5. And of course, that didn't last very long. My mom brought him back within a few months, but they didn't bring me back for, I think, a year, year and a half.
So. Oh, wow. So that there's a number on you, right? I mean, sound like a positive thing for you.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, when you're 10 years old, I don't think of it as traumatic. I was just like, oh, this is cool. You know, who are these people? And you don't get to process all those meanings. And you know, it wasn't like I didn't have my parents anymore. I knew they were there and I see them once in a while. So when you're 10, you're just like living your life. but I did, you know, the one thing that people do say is that for many years is that my English is really good. And that was a force lesson. I had to learn how to speak it without an accent mostly, and learn how to, the Americans' way of living. You know, I was watching stuff like, you know, Sesame Street and all that stuff. And so at 10 years old, it wasn't a terrible thing. I think in retrospect, I would do that to some of my worst enemies, but that's how it went.
But at 10, wouldn't your mom and dad fight back and say, whoa, like, you're pulling our family apart? How could they have thought that that was okay?
I've never talked to them. I know that they didn't like it, and that's why they went and got Viet back really quick. But you know, refugee parents are hard to understand. Partly, you know, my wife and I talk about this all the time. Like, Vietnamese parents, at least in my generation, weren't hands-on. They weren't helicopters. Right. Even in Vietnam, they were like, most of the day, they didn't see me. I was running around doing whatever I was doing. So that connection of, like, I have to be physically be there for the person may not be the most important thing. I think it's the emotion, the feelings. They loved me. I didn't doubt that for a minute. They had to make a living, so that they had to do that. It was hard. It's a hard living. They wouldn't have seen me much anyway. they would have been at work all the time. So you know, not without really understanding what was going on in their head. I think it was bad, but it wasn't as bad as we think from where we are and the way we learn to expect what families and parents and children should be doing. So
by the time the whole family reunited, where and what was that like?
Yeah, no, we my parents managed to get bought a house, which sounds like a lot of big deal, but in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in the mid-1970s, it wasn't very much at all. It's still a pretty depressed town, and you know, property prices are still pretty low. But they did get a house and brought both of us back. My parents started working in, funny enough, they both got job in a nursing home's laundry. And they were never big, you know, manual laborers. So they both got fired, I think, from that job. And then my dad went to work as an assembler for a typewriter company. Yeah. Even the typewriters don't exist anymore. So, you know, and my mom was home most of the time, and the kids went to school, and that was kind of like, okay, you know, we had snow, we had, you know, a lot of cool stuff that I never seen before. So that was nice.
And that reintegration process, was it comfortable for you?
I don't remember being difficult. I mean, it could have been, but you know, I'm a pretty go with the flow kind of guy, even back then. And And my parents are, you know, they're not worried about emotional trauma or any of that stuff. They were like, hey, he's back. He's eating. You know, I was like eating them out house and home because I was, you know, entering my teenage years. And they're like, oh, yeah, no. Before he wasn't home at night, but now at 10 o'clock at night, he's eating a stack of toast with butter. And that's okay.
So my observation of you for the last few years and your brother, I actually met him when I was an undergrad at USC. He was coming in to teach. We have this, you know, preconception of who you two are based on what we see and what we read. But I think about what were the things that your parents instilled in both of you to turn out two really powerful forces in the Vietnamese American and Vietnamese American society?
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure that's not what they set out to do. I know that they didn't set out to have an author for a son. They did set out to have a doctor for a son. So, and that's probably the first lesson for any parent is that, and I'm a parent now, I have three kids, all of whom are either adults or on the edge of adulthood. And the most important lesson is they will take the lessons you teach them, but they will do it and turn it out their own way. If that makes sense. And you may not like it, but it really was you who gave them the lessons. And you know, the main thing that my parents taught both me and my brother, I mean, there are a couple of things. The first thing is that never be afraid of hard work. They work hard in Vietnam, they work hard in Pennsylvania, and later when they came to San Jose, they work really hard. I mean, they work way harder than most people. They were lucky in that when they worked hard, they got rewarded monetarily. So unlike a lot of people who work hard who don't get a lot of money, they had a decent amount of money. But my parents, when they owned the stores in San Jose that they own, they worked 360 days a year. They took it off. They took Christmas off. That's it. They worked days, nights, weekends, and they roped us into doing the work too. So it wasn't like we were immune from that. So this whole example of like how hard, so sometimes when I went to medical school and I went to residency and I'm working really hard and we had 80-hour weeks and I was really tired and I didn't like it, but I was like, oh yeah, well, my parents, this was like the norm for my parents. So what am I complaining about, you know? And not necessarily a healthy thing, but I think that's just what we got from them. They also were very, very entrepreneurial. And that was actually the thing that I underestimated. Like my parents were very business oriented and both my parents went from not having much of an education in North Vietnam to being successful merchant in South Vietnam and then to becoming successful people in the United States. And you don't get to do that in two different refugee experiences if you're not resourceful and entrepreneurial. And even though I don't think I have any business sense whatsoever, I took the entrepreneurial and the resourcefulness with me. In my career, I'm very fond of telling people, I'm always the example in medicine of the person who didn't know what the heck they were doing, made a lot of mistakes and still came out really well. And that's because every time I tried something that worked out was great, and I tried something that didn't work out, I still made it into something that worked out. And then I ended up doing what I wanted to do all along. And that's probably the thing that they gave me the most, which is both the ability to do hard work, the ability not to expect too much, and then the ability to move around and sort of make changes. I wrote this in my Facebook post about neglect. Like it was kind of like a benign neglect. They weren't riding me all the time. They just kind of set these broad parameters. The other thing that they taught us, which was that you also have to contribute to the community. So even though they work really hard, they were always part of the Catholic community in San Jose, for example. And my dad became a leader there in his sort of middle age years and did a lot there. And so again, I'm not a leader in the Catholic community, but I think I'm working with Vietnamese American communities in other ways.
Now, do you find that your children go as hard as you and your brother do?
No, but they probably go harder than other kids, if that makes sense. And they go harder their own way. So one of them had to be ridden pretty hard, and one of them basically said, "Leave me alone." And one of them is right in the middle, you know. And so as a parent, you sort of have to figure, you know, that's the one thing I think about parenthood that I think a lot of Vietnamese parents don't get is they use the same style all the time.
Right.
And I think each kid responds differently. And so rather than, you know, again, like my parents did, draw broad parameters, and within that you have to, you know, adjust to the child. And so, but they all work hard. I mean, they're all academically ambitious. None of them are going to be successful business people like their grandparents, but you know.
And you know, this is a common theme I search for all the time, wondering what the third, fourth generation Vietnamese American will look like. You know, we're inheritors of such a beautiful struggle. I mean, at the end of, you know, we can stand back after all these years and say, you know, the struggle that they went through, the difficulty, we inherited the strength and the power, the resilience, the persistence that we see modeled in our parents. But the next generation, it's lost. And it's, you know, it's like when you transfer computer files or video files, it loses its generation.
I tend to be more, I'm not sure the right word is optimistic, but I tend to see or outcome-oriented thinking as being not helpful. Hmm. In other words, I'm always a process person, particularly when it comes to human beings. And if I'm doing a project, I would want some outcomes. But when you're raising children or growing up or deciding who you are and what you want to be, those are all process stuff. There's never an ultimate outcome out of it. And so, for example, like my parents, the most important thing to them, because I grew up so poor, my mom was like, you know, if you ever watch, you know, these, you know, stereotypical thing of Vietnamese young women rowing the boat down the stream to sell, you know, goods at the market, that she was like that. She was doing that since she was 13. And so they were so poor that all they wanted was a decent economic life for their kids so they didn't have to suffer. Okay. And then when it came to me, I knew that was there, and you know, I worked on it. And what I wanted for my kids was the opportunity for them to choose the things they want to do most in life. And sometimes my wife and I sit and complain, like, "Oh, our kids are not, you know, they're not driven like we are. They're not, you know, doing this, blah blah blah." And then we say to ourselves, "Well, that was the whole point. The whole point is that we want to make a better life for them, so they don't have to do all the things that we had to do to get here, you know. And so why are we complaining about that?" The most important thing is to embrace them for who they are and who they want to be within some parameters. Like, you don't want them to be turned out to be, you know, somebody who's a criminal or somebody, you know, heaven forbid, so committed to money that they don't think about anything else around them, you know. But they do need to have a certain amount of, you know, financial security so they can live their lives and raise their kids so that so they don't end up where my parents were when they were poor, right? So you don't want that cycle. That's not the cycle you want, right? It's like, you know, grandparents poor, parents okay, you know, well doing, the grandkids are and then the great grandkids are poor again. You know, that's a very classic family cycle. Yes. By the way, you don't want that, but you know, like my brother turned out to be this great author. No one ever predicted that for him, except for maybe him, and everyone admires him, right? Well, my kids might not ever be a great doctor or a great business person, but who knows what they're going to do. And I think from the parents' perspective, because now I'm sort of I know both sides now, right? Very classic thing, like, you're not going to know what's going on until you become parents. Well, I get it now. You know, I get it. Like, I need to enjoy the children growing into the person they want to grow into. As long as they're within the broad parameters of being a good person. That's it.
Yeah.
And I think most Vietnamese American youth, young people think that way, you know?
Were you close to your mom and dad?
Again, not in the classic Americans, you know, white Americans, white middle class American sense of being close. We didn't spend a ton of time together. It's very funny because in my family, my kids, I'm the notorious one for showing up to everything my kids did. I you know, they were like, they love my wife, but they think I want to be there for them all the time. And that's sort of the weird thing, right? Because a lot of people think that they go together. Like, a lot of people now raising kids are like, you love them, you be there for them, right?
Right.
But that's not how kids think about it. Like, you can have love and you don't have to show up, and you can show up and you don't necessarily get love just because you show up. I mean, they love me, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
But my parents never showed up for anything. Because I were working 360 days a year. You know, they showed up for, I mean, I did all kinds of extracurricular activities. They never showed up. They showed up for my high school graduation. My dad flew across the country to my college graduation. My mom didn't because she was running the store, you know. And so when you think about these sort of classic way of being and the expectations, and I didn't think that was lacking. I didn't know any better. And then by the time I figured out that it could have been better, I would have wanted to spend more time with my parents. I understood why it didn't happen, right? Because they were busy, you know,
right.
Living and making a living so that I can go do all these other things. So I think the way I would say is we're very close, but we're not physically close. And we're not even talking close. In other words, we don't necessarily, I mean, my mom never shared a whole ton of things. I mean, she would drop like these mystery statements and I would have to try to figure it out, but she won't talk about it. And then my dad talked a lot, but he talked a lot about the things that he cared about, yeah. Which was the Catholic Church, making money, and basically that was it. And you know, we try to figure out our commonalities through that, you know? He talked about his music too, because I didn't want to make him turn into like a, you know, this stodgy person, but he does have an artistic side to him, so.
Your mother, you said that there wasn't a whole lot, you know, she spoke cryptically, it sounded like, but you know, we've talked about her mental health. At some point, you're finally ready to talk about it. And I'm curious, what led to her condition?
So the first thing as a doctor I will say is that there are many potential explanations, but illness is illness. And there's usually an underlying biological problem.
Mm.
All right, so just let's start out with that, okay? Because I don't want us to talk about experiences that mean a lot and then say, well, it was those experiences that made her the way she was.
Right.
Not everyone who goes with those experiences has those same health outcomes, although they're more likely to have those health outcomes, right? But I want you to understand that the interplay between experience and trauma and biology regarding mental health is not clear cut. But as a doctor, I try to, because the Vietnamese American people are so fixated on not Vietnamese American, but a lot of traditional Vietnamese people are very fixated on the idea that there's no, if something is wrong with the way you think and the way you feel, that it's not is something wrong with you as a person morally, as opposed to something biologically wrong with your brain. Okay. And I want to make sure that we are clear that when someone's, you know, depressed or anxious, there are actually biological things going on. And in the same way that my biology makes me look the way I do and your biology makes you look the way you do, the biology of a person who gets an experience and become depressed might be different from the biology of a person who have an experience and don't become, you know, have a major depression episode. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect
sense. I just
want
to make that very clear.
And I don't know how many people are actually thinking like that. I mean, outside, you know, as a layperson, I've never thought of that. I've always thought, you know, these traumatic events trigger these things and we go into tailspins because we can't deal with it and we need mental health professionals to help. Yeah.
My one of my most favorite saying that I came up with, oh, I'm not sure somebody else probably came up with too, but there are no simple answer to a complex problem. Okay. So that's why all the people out there with, you know, beliefs that you're kind of like, they're trying to get a simple answer to a complex problem. And even if the simple answer has some truth and some relationship to the complex problem, it's not enough, right? So like, I mean, take a classic example of the COVID people. They're like, oh, the COVID vaccine cannot work because some people who get the vaccine gets COVID. They don't understand that there's a lot more going on there than just that, right? But that's how they hang their hat on these single things. And that's why I want to make sure that complex things are understood as complex things. And when you do that, then what actually that does is it allows you to do two things. One is to delve deeper into exactly what that is. And the second is give you some humility and think about, even though you think you know what this is, you still don't. And I don't, actually. If you ask me why this Vietnamese person became depressed and that Vietnamese person didn't become depressed, I can come up with a list of potential explanations, but I still couldn't tell you with certainty that this is what happened. Right?
Yes. And this has given me a better framework to ask questions now in my own work, because I tend to ask very binary questions. It's either this or that. Because that's sort of the way we kind of think. We want like simple answers. It's like, oh, you do that and then you become successful. You do that, you avoid criminal, you know, or you do that and you will stay healthy. But there's so much complexity in everything and not just health and politics.
Yeah. Remember the binary thinking? I don't know. I mean, classically, binary thinking is more Western. And, you know, yin yang is not binary, right? You know, the concept of yin and yang, which is the, you know, one side influencing the other, is more Eastern. Although there is a lot of binary thinking in Eastern culture too. But I just want to, you know, and this started out with my conversation with talking about the sympathizer and then one side and the other side, Vietnamese American identity, one side and the other side. And what I think you're getting your hand on it, which is that there is nothing simple about any of this. And you can even draw a pole here and a pole here, but in between, all this thing moves back and forth all the time. Okay, so if you really want to get into, you know, one of my scientific, you know, belief is that people don't understand probability. They think it's zero or one, it's right. 0% or 100%. They don't understand that there's nothing 0% except birth, and nothing 0% except 100% except death. Okay. And in between, there's nothing that's zero and one. And trying to live your life as zero and ones, we're not machines. We're not computers. We don't live in zeros and ones. We live in a lot of, you know, in between, okay? And, you know, people say, you're very successful. I'm like, well, yes, but not 100% successful, you know? Or, you know, things like that. So, I mean, I just want to introduce this idea of fluidity. And the same thing, you know, you think about COVID, you know, people, and you're like, oh, they don't believe in COVID. No, they're each of those groups, you can break them down into smaller and smaller groups. And so, you know, and the thing is, I do health education for a living, and I try to convince patients to do the right thing. And if I approach every patient as zeros or ones,
right,
it's never going to work. It has to be each person, each thing at each time, you know?
You get pretty philosophical for a medical doctor. What's the root? Why did you study philosophy at Harvard?
Because I was growing up, they're like, he's such a philosopher, you know? And I was like, well, you know, if they're going to tell me that, then maybe I should figure out what the heck that is. And, you know, and I went into, but I think philosophy is not necessarily a great measure. I did become a philosopher, and I can talk about why that was, but it teaches you how to think and to challenge your assumptions. Okay. And in science, that science does that too, but it does it in a much more rigid way. Scientists, you know, they have certain ways of thinking and certain ways of doing things. And yes, they want to prove this or disprove that, but they're very, most of the time, at least the way that scientists, the way I used to think about them when I was young, was very, again, very zeros and ones. Is this true? Is this not true? You know? And then arts was, you know, the other option was, you know, more the humanities and literature. And there was no zeros and ones, but there was like really no direction at all. Like it could be anything. And I was not that kind of person. I was not ready to be the kind of person. So I tried to straddle those two. So philosophy, you know, in the old days, actually, philosophers were scientists. You know, there's a philosophy of science, you know, before Newton. Maybe there was a philosopher who thought about what Newton thought about before he proved it mathematically, right? So you know, in the old days, philosophers really, we're still pushing the boundaries a little bit, but nobody listens to us anymore. but you know, that's why I wanted to do it. And then I did it, and then I realized that for me, I'm both a thinker and a doer. And philosophy is too much thinking and not enough doing. And so my job was to figure out a job where I could do a lot of thinking and a lot of doing. So
what inspired you to go to med school?
Oh, I'm Vietnamese. My parents wanted a doctor. I'm joking. I'm totally joking.
At Harvard, you finished with a philosophy degree, but did you think about medical school at that time?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm a refugee kid. I mean, come on, man. I always have a plan B and a plan C. It was never, you know, there's no, I mean, my brother went wholeheartedly into his arts. And I'm like, no, he didn't, actually. He became an English professor. You know, if he was really committed 100%, he would have gone into a novel writing job, not a professor job, right? He had a plan B and a plan C, too. And me, I definitely have multiple plans. And when I went to went to college, I said, I'm going to be a philosophy major. I'm going to do pre-med, too. Because I don't know how it's going to work out, you know. And my parents had already, you know, primed me to become a doctor. I actually didn't want to become a doctor because they kept telling me I wanted to become a doctor. so that's why I kind of got this middle way in college of like, oh, philosophy and medicine, you know. And so I could do both. And so that's what I did.
So when did you start to become a little bit more political?
Oh, that's a long way. The idea started in probably college. I remember this event absolutely distinctly. It was so like most of my college life, I don't remember a thing, but this event I remember. There was a I was at Harvard, and there was a place there called the Kennedy School of Public Policy, and it was pretty new at that time when I was there. And they held a conference on the Vietnamese War, the residual of the Vietnamese War. Okay, and I was actually, that I was like a junior. I was the president of the Vietnamese Student Association, which consisted of like eight people, and we went, right? Like, I was like, we have to go. It's about the Vietnam War. The entire panel and everything that they were talking about were white people. They were like white people talking about white people experience in Vietnam. Very smart and knowledgeable white people. And I'm standing up there. I wasn't even on the first floor of this meeting. I was like on the balcony. That's how far back I was. And I, for no reason, I did not plan to do it. I just shouted out. I said, "What about the Vietnamese people's perspective in all of this?" That's what I said. And I was mortified that I said it. I was like, "Holy cow, I'm interrupting this huge meeting. And what the heck? I'm like a really, button down guy. Why would I go and do something like that?" But then the rest of my life, it's been moments like that where it just comes out. It's not like I deliberately plan it, but that's how I recognize that I've gotten to the point where I'm fed up with whatever it was that was going on. I mean, I'm a very deliberate person. I would plan things. I would work behind the scene on things. But when I come out and say something that's harsh, it's because I think that I couldn't take it anymore. And I think it has to be said. Generally, I have positive reinforcement. People say, you say things that we've been thinking, and that sort of encourages me to do it. But that was a moment, and I think I was like, I was afraid to go home and see my friends in the VSA. Or like, did they think I was like an idiot, or did they think I was like, because the Vietnamese and Asian ideas that you can't be loud and
Keep your
vocal.
mouth shut, yeah.
Yeah, keep your mouth shut. The nail that sticks up gets pounded down. And why did I say that? But I mean, now we complain about it all the time, right? Oh, you have a mantle, all white, all men and no women on this topic, right? If you have a Vietnam War conversation now and there is no Vietnamese people,
We
you
have
should just never
problems. Yeah.
bother. I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous, right? I didn't know about any of that stuff back then. I just felt it,
And what was the repercussions in the room?
Nothing. Nobody pay attention to me. And that's actually not an unusual response to when you're working with minority causes in this country. White people don't pay attention. And they were just like, oh, they didn't even like do anything.
There's
It
no.
was, I don't know. I mean, I again, I straddle sort of authority and anti-authority positions all the time. And, this came later, like in the 1990, early 1990s when the AIDS epidemic was going on. I was a health provider, and I like to do think about health research. And all the health researchers were like, yeah, leave it to us to do this work to solve the AIDS problem. And all the people with AIDS were like, no, we're dying, why aren't we part of this conversation? And when I talk about things like community engaged research and coalition building and all that stuff, I live this now. You can't do the work or talk about somebody else's issue unless they're there. Okay, you can't. You cannot. And maybe that was where it started, that moment when I stood up there without me really thinking about it, and say, well, why are you talking about a war that killed a million Vietnamese Americans and there was no Vietnamese person there? Or even, if you were, they may have put a Vietnamese person there someday, but it would be somebody from the north and not a Vietnamese American in America where there was hundreds of thousands of us,
Since your time at that Kennedy Center outburst to today, do you feel like the engagement in the public is more engaged in politics, less engaged, or is it sort of a wave? How do you feel about it, especially Vietnamese American engagement?
The Vietnamese Americans in general have always been engaged in politics when it came to Vietnam and communism. They got loud, they get rude, they get angry for good reasons. There are a lot of emotional issues and real trauma that they were working on. But they stayed away from American politics otherwise for years. I knew this. I watched it. They didn't engage at all. And then, of course, even if you engage in American politics, if you engage it in a way that the people who were worried about communism and all that stuff didn't like, that would just call you a communist and, you know, forget about you, you know. And so for many, many years, I did not deal with politics. So until I was actually, you know, we'll get that in a minute. But my attitude once I became a doctor and a researcher was, you know, there's a Vietnamese saying that's actually the name of one of the projects that we have, Sức khỏe là vàng, right? Health is gold, right? Health is gold. And I intuitively understood that the way to empowerment and political activism is through health. And now you are seeing it all over the place, right? But I could not go into a Vietnamese American community and say, let's talk about democracy. Let's talk about,
right,
you know, exercising our power. It'll be like a no starter. Now they won't trust me, or they'll try to turn me toward whatever their ideology was. But if I went in there and say, let's talk about health, and they're like, yeah, let's talk about health, and then we're like, well, why is this not happening? Why is this not happening? Why is this not happening? Like, why is it that you don't have a doctor who speaks Vietnamese? Why is it that when you go, when you're a 50-year-old, you know, nail salon worker, that you can't get health insurance, or you can't afford health care, right? I mean, you start asking those kinds of questions, and then people are like, oh, I care about my health, I care about my family, and this is why I'm not getting what I need, what do I need to do? You work people toward empowerment by looking at that, rather than the other way around, working on empowerment so you can get them to help. Does it make sense?
Yes, makes perfect sense.
And I did that for like 20 years. And that makes sense to me because I care about health, I do health. And ultimately, to be honest, I mean, we can argue all day about what kind of job you want, but listen, when you get sick, your health is number one, okay? The fact that you cannot worry about your health is actually a privilege. Right. As a person who deals with people who are sick all the time, the fact that 90% of us go around every day not thinking a thing about their health is a huge privilege. But when you do get unhealthy, then all you care about mostly is your health. You care about your family too, obviously. But so I was very happy doing that until I got to the point where I realized there was only so much I could do in health and empowerment without going over to the political side. And that was because when I was appointed, so I was doing all this stuff, and I got appointed to the Obama Commission on Asian American and Pacific Islanders. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, and now I have an opportunity to make changes that I couldn't do as a researcher, as a doctor, as a community person. And here's the government, this is great. You know, I can tell.
Before you go on, how do you get just appointed to do something like that?
Yeah. Well, there are ways, but that's not how I did it. So this is, you know, this is the why. I mean, well, I really mean it when I say my life. If you look at people, look at me, they're like, "Oh, he's so." Well, maybe some people will say that, but he's so successful. He must have done all this, and I'm like, no, I'm just like wandering around, you know, picking up stuff all the time, you know, and I really mean this actually, because everybody tells a story about how they became successful. I'm always very skeptical. I'm always very skeptical, okay? Because the same person, another person could have the same exact story to tell who wasn't successful. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense.
You only listen to the person who's successful. All the guys wandering out there going, oh, I did this and this, just like that guy, but I'm not successful. Nobody's listening to them. Okay, so just, you know, take everything with a grain of salt. Every single advice that someone gives you about your career may or may not work for you. And the point is, if it doesn't work out, were you happy doing it? Okay, so that's how I, you know, I tell people this. I'm like, you know, I don't follow any particular path. Anyway, so back to this. So I was, you know, a reasonably successful researcher, and I had like started thinking about policy. So I said to someone who's now a very successful health policy person, but she was only okay at that time. I said to her, hey, I know you're interested in health policy. I want to get into it. Do you have any opportunities for me? And she's like, okay, apply for this fellowship. I apply for this fellowship. I didn't get it, all right? And I'm like, okay, whatever. Then President Obama came, and he created the commission, and he appointed a bunch of commissioners. And it was very clear that they were trying to pick every Asian ethnicity, like Chinese, Yao Zhao, the Asian, Filipino. They didn't have a Vietnamese person. And the Vietnamese community were like up in arms, like the one who cared, were like up in arms, like, where's the Vietnamese person, right? it turns out, and I didn't find out about this until later, was that number one, the Vietnamese Americans were so argumentative that they couldn't agree on anyone. Okay? Oh. So that's number one. Number two, the people that came in to be considered either didn't pass vetting for whatever reason, I don't know why, there's a huge vetting process, or they had some opposition within the Vietnamese American community. Okay? This is what happens when you don't pay attention to the politics where you live and you only pay attention to the politics back home. Okay? They were fighting each other about what's going on in Vietnam, and here's a prime opportunity for them to do something here, and they did. So they're like, oh, we're desperate. We need to find a Vietnamese person. So what better than to find a Vietnamese person no one's ever heard of? So what happened was that the chair of the commission called this was when the Affordable Care Act was coming in. So they're like, we need somebody who has health, because they didn't have anybody with health experience on the commission at that time. They had the people from community organizations, politics, business, and all that stuff. And they asked this woman, and she would have been on the commission, but she was Chinese. So they're like, oh, you need somebody who's health and Vietnamese. And over time, I built up that reputation as the Vietnamese American health person, who's actually Vietnamese. There are other people who did that work who weren't Vietnamese. And she knew I was interested, so she said, Tung, you want to talk to the chair of the commission? And I did. And that's how I got into commission.
Yeah, that's a really random...
Very random. And it changed my life. It's like, again, processes. You tell people you're interested, you do the best job you can for what you do, and then the opportunity comes. Of course, the opportunity never comes. So you can't take my story and say, you should take that path, right? There are plenty of people like me who didn't get asked, right? So you know, I'm not taking any credit for any of this stuff.
Right.
It's just how things are. Yeah, well, but then you think about the Vietnamese American refugee experience. Everybody did the same thing, and some people made it to the United States, some people never did, and some people die on the way. Okay, you can't look at that and say, well, we did something better, that's why we're alive, and they did something bad, and that's why they're dead. You know, it's fortune, right? It's whether it's you have faith or you have belief in luck or whatever. These are the random events that happen to people, and that's why I don't put a lot of stake on success versus not success. A lot of it's very random. So,
God, I want to ask this question, but I hope you don't get offended. Your father was Catholic. Sounds like a very strong Catholic, as my father and mother were. Where does that place you today? With the
me
luck?
Personally?
Yes, you personally, with luck and God and life and, you know.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Does it have much of an influence on you?
When I was younger, I didn't believe the way they did. They believed very much that it was their faith that got them through, you know, the Northern-Southern Petition in 1954. Made them successful in South Vietnam, got them out of the country, kept them alive, made them successful in the United States. There was no question in their mind that it was their faith that did it, okay? And I don't blame them, because again, like I said, how else do you explain it? You know, they had to have an explanation, okay? You know what I said before about simple answers to complex questions? Religion is a relatively simple answer to a very complex question, and it's a part of the answer. And so I feel like I'm not a devout Catholic. I haven't rejected it. I don't, you know, the Catholic Church itself has shown itself to be very, very oppressive. And some of the thing that turned me off was obviously the way they treat women, the way they treat children, in the pedophilia, but in general. So I can't, you know, as an institution, I don't subscribe to it too much. I mean, I like the Pope, and I still go to church every week because my dad goes to church and I have to take him, you know. But it's not, to me as an institution, I don't buy into the Catholic Church. But I do believe that there are some other forces going on besides me and my own doing. I don't know what that is. I think it's God, but I could be wrong. I mean, again, I'm very comfortable now at my age living with uncertainty and with complexity when there's no simple things.
But when you're sitting in the pew with your father and you're listening to the homily or the first gospel or second gospel readings, do you engage or are you checked out?
Well, I'm not engaged anymore because I've heard them a million times. I mean, I hear them all the time. It's the same. I mean, really, it's the same story every year. You know, so from a standpoint of entertainment, no. But, you know, there are messages in the Catholic Church that are, I think, unbelievably cool. I mean, certainly if you look at Jesus as a liberator rather than a institution, everything he says, you know, everything he says about the poor, about the foreigners, how he treats women are good things.
On point, yeah. There's nothing...
Just because a bunch of other guys decided to turn to some other weird thing doesn't mean that he was what he says or what supposedly he says that other people copy down, right, was wrong. I mean, but then that's like the case with most religion. Most religion have a lot of truth in them. Or, no, forget the word truth. I don't even know that that's true. But have a lot of insight and guidance that we all should pay attention to. That's what I care about. So going
back to this appointment in the Obama administration, you were there for how many years?
Yesterday was the swearing in of this current commission. And they asked me to come back to talk to them. And I told them that I was so bad the first time that they had to make me do a remedial term on the commission. So the original commission was appointed, I think, in 2010. They invited me to come on in 2011, and then it ended in 2012. So I was invited back with the second commission because he has his second term, Obama did, and he has a second commission, and I was on the second term, and I was chair for the second term. So I went from 2012 to 2017. So what happened was when Trump won in November of 2016, a lot of us were on the commission had a serious conversation with each other, like, what are we going to do? Because obviously Trump was not someone that we felt was good for the Asian American Pacific Islander communities. And there were three groups. There was the one group that says, we're leaving. We're resigning no matter what. We don't want to work for this guy. Another group that says, we're staying on. We have to stay on because we have to moderate whatever it is that he's going to do. And a bunch of us were sort of in the middle. I was in the middle. But I was a chair, so I couldn't really... I didn't want to come out and say what was on my mind because a chair is a weird position in that way. But then what happened was he came into office and then he passed the Muslim ban. This was like a few days right after he went into office. And all of us were sitting there looking at each other and we're like, well, hey, wait a minute. You know, one of the reasons why we're here is the Japanese Americans got put into concentration camp. And this guy's anti-Muslim and he's banning. I mean, how could you possibly justify serving? And so a bunch of us resigned, including me. But at that moment in time, I had decided that it was my personal values at stake, not as the chair of the commission. I think four of them stayed on, and they stayed on for a year or two, but they didn't really get anything done. But the rest of us, I think something like 13 or 14 of us resigned. And it remains the biggest mass resignation from Trump's administration, as far as we know. So.
And looking back, do you think that was the right thing to walk away from?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, you know, you get to be in some position of power and you get to make decisions. And you have to ask yourself, well, why do you want to be in power in the first place? It wasn't powerful. I mean, the commission is not that big of a deal. But for me, it was relative power. So, you know, why do you want to be in power in the first place? Well, I want to be power because I want to carry out my values and my policies and my thinking. Okay, fine. You have to make compromises. So sometimes you have to compromise your value and your policies to stay in power, right? But then if you're just staying in power for the sake of staying in power, then why are you in power? You know, and I just realized, you know, I can't work for somebody who's completely against everything I believe. Yeah, they can make me vice president and I still could do anything I wanted, right? So if I wouldn't take that position, why would I be sort of a figurehead? Because actually, you actually end up being a sort of like, oh, look, he cares about API. He still has his commission. Look at these commissioners. He loves Asian Americans. I know some Asian Americans, you know. I'm a racist, but I know some Asian Americans. Mm. You know, I don't want to serve that role for him, you know. And so it was really no question in my mind. You know, some people say, well, you should have stayed on and do something. And you saw over the course of this administration that people who decided to stay on and do something.
Dropping like flies.
Doing nothing, you know. Yeah. They just basically, you know, are just basically tools for what he wanted and what his people wanted. And so I think we made the right decision.
So then when you left there, what ideas did you have to stay engaged in the political arena?
So one of the things that I did on the commission, which was really hard for me, is because I was the only Vietnamese American. I think in the second term there was Linda Phan, who came from Texas. But wherever I went, like, Vietnamese people would approach me because, you know, it's a big deal. You're on the, you know, nobody understand that an advisory commission is an advisory commission, but they say it's a White House advisory commission, so you must like be in the White House all the time. And so they think it's a big deal, so they come and talk to me, and they're always trying to pitch things. Like, people who come and talk to a commissioner, it's always has some agenda, either an issue that they want to pitch or themselves that they want to pitch, okay? So, because everyone have access to power, right? So, and I really try to avoid the older Vietnamese people, because I knew that if they came up to me, there were chances are they're going to talk to me about Vietnam and communism and all that stuff. And we made it very clear on the commission that we don't talk foreign policy. We have no control over foreign policy, so don't talk to us about it. And I love that, because I don't, then I didn't have to like piss anybody off. I was like, oh, sorry, I'm on the commission. If you're talking to me as a commissioner, I can't talk to you about foreign policy. Okay. But I was always nervous when they came up to me, because I knew, because it's been this way for 40 years. Okay. Right. It's like this obsession. Okay. You know, I mean, again, I'm not trying to denigrate anyone. I know that people suffer. People had friends and families who died in the war and all this stuff. Okay. But it's been 40 years. Okay. And your children and your grandchildren are growing up here. They're not going back to Vietnam and living there. There is no revolution coming in Vietnam, as far as I can tell. You know, so what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Why can't we stay focused on the work that's here? Because when you already go talk about Vietnam, it was very divisive, right? Like, everybody hated each other, whatever position you were taking. And so you could not organize a Vietnamese American political force if you allow Vietnam to come into it. And so I said, let's look around for who's doing Vietnamese American work. And I found almost nothing. There were some organizations. They're sort of, you know, straddling the fence, and either they were really into the service provision, which is great. They provide services to the community, or they were like refugee type organization that still goes back to Vietnam and do all that stuff. Those are basically the two big Vietnamese types of organizations. And I say, who's working on our issues, you know, at the highest policy level? And we didn't find any. So that's why I started PIVOT, the Progressive Vietnamese American Organization. And it was a mess too, because, you know, to even put that group together was a huge mess, like a lot of arguments and all kinds of stuff. One of the nice things someone ever said to me afterwards was somebody who is very experienced in Vietnamese American community stuff came up to me and said, look, you know, when I went to the first meeting, I was like, oh, it's going to be more of the same stuff. People sitting there arguing with each other and, you know, throwing their ideology around. And you guys were doing that, but I was watching how you were doing it, and I was like, oh, maybe there's something here. And he said, yeah. And then it turned out that even though it was messy the first few months, I think we came. And I think the reason why we were able to coalesce was because we said no talk about foreign policy, nothing. That was too divisive. We knew that even in a room of 100 progressive Vietnamese American, if you brought up Vietnam, there'll be like 40 different viewpoints. So, and you just cannot coalesce around that.
Wow, that is a key factor in the success of PIVOT. It's such a mess, a vortex of just like, it's just like, you can't solve it. The emotions that people feel.
Yeah, and I think I never discount anyone's emotion and their experience and what they care about. But sometimes, and I'm a doctor, so take my word for it, people avoid one thing by thinking about another thing. This is a classic way of dealing with things, with life, right? So on the one hand, yes, you care a lot about Vietnam and what happened and all that stuff. But on the other hand, you're not paying attention to your kids and your family here. Why is that? You know, sometimes it's because life here is really hard, and you can't make changes. Particularly if you're poor or you know, underempowered, you're like, oh, look at all these bad things happening to my family, and I had to work so hard, and why is it like this, you know? And you think about it, and you're like, But I'm a powerful person. Why is this happening? And the way you turn that around in one way is to say, I want to work on something else that matters. And even though they're both sort of like limited outcomes, right? On the one hand, you're still struggling economically here, and you're certainly not overturning the Communist Party in Vietnam. Somehow it feels better to be working on something over there than something over here, you know? And I was never like that. I'm a doctor, you know? I got to deal with the problem in front of me. The problem in front of me is not what's happening in Vietnam. I mean, I love the Vietnamese people. I want them to do well, but it's not my business. I have no right to go to Vietnam and tell the Vietnamese people living there how their government should be. Okay, it's their job. It's their position. That's what they have to do. I don't know what it is, but they have to do it. It can't be me. Okay. Whereas I live here in this country. I'm a Vietnamese person living in the United States. I have every right to decide what happens here in this country. As a matter of fact, if every Vietnamese person in Vietnam thought think the way I do about being Vietnamese American in America, you know, that maybe the revolution they need, right? But I'm not talking about that. I'm just like saying that you have to engage and live the life that you're in. Stop thinking about what happened yesterday or what happened 3,000 miles away.
So this had to be repeated over and over in the early days of Pivot then, right?
No, because this is the most amazing thing. I have nothing to do with it. All I did was put a pole in the ground and say, come join us. And everybody came. Because you know why? A lot of people felt like me. I told you, like when I was standing in a room and I was going to say something, there are a lot of people who comes and tells me, yeah. Oh, I felt exactly the same way. Well, this is what happened. They're like, oh my God, I didn't know there were these people who think like this. I thought everyone was like anti-communist, pro-Republican, pro, you know. And I'm like, no, actually. You know, they have to give these polls about how Vietnamese American votes and stuff like that. And they're like, oh yeah, you know, they vote Republican. No, that's not true. In the past, it was like 55% Republican, 45% Democrat, you know, or 65%. But really, a lot of Vietnamese American are in the middle, you know. And so this narrative that the Vietnamese American are Republicans is ridiculous. Like, again, zeros and ones, right? Yeah. You're either Republican or you're Democrat. No, most Vietnamese Americans are in the middle, okay? And a lot of them are Democrats and a lot of them are Republicans, okay? And depending on the topic, the middle slides one way or the other, right? And so all these people who are in the middle who wanted to be a little lefty, and all the lefties or Democrats are like, oh my God, there is actually a Vietnamese American group that actually thinks this way. And that's how we approach Pivot. If anyone comes to us and say, what's Pivot about? I'm like, what do you want it to be about? we're not here to tell you exactly. I mean, we're here to help you coordinate and do, but people are like, oh, what do you think Pivot's gonna be? I'm like, look, we have a mission statement, we have a vision statement, you wanna read it, that's fine, it's there. But how we implement it, how we operationalize it is up to you. Mm. And a lot of people are like, I wanna join Pivot. And then later, like, well, why are you asking me to do all this stuff? I'm like, well, why did you join Pivot? You know, you're going to give us money. You're going to do some work. Okay? We're not an organization that's for you to join and have, you know, food, you know, I mean, have food. Let's have fun. But you're going to work or give us money. I mean, I'm just blunt right now. Like, you can be a Pivot follower and a Pivot sympathizer, whatever term you want to use. But if you want to be in Pivot, you work. Or you give us money, or you do both, okay? We're not here. We're not people who are just gonna sit and be passive. I think that separates us a little bit from other organizations. We are not gonna sit and be passive, and we're not gonna be top down necessarily. A lot of our big projects that came from people who are in Pivot for a particular reason. They wanted to push this thing, and we enable them to do it, okay? And that's how you do community engagement. Okay.
So what is the structure like? You said it's not top down, and you've emphasized that. How do you function? How do you operate?
Well, we have a board of directors, and the board is very hands on. Like, a lot of boards are strategic and raise money. That's like how most board of directors work. But because we have no staff, or we had no staff, we actually for the last 5 years. A lot of us, you know, are actually out there creating programs and projects and doing it and recruiting, you know, volunteers. And then we also pay some consultants to do the work. That's basically it. We have a bunch of committees so that we at least have some areas that we work on. So, for example, we have a policy committee that looks at policies that are relevant, and then they come up with strategy of addressing those policies. We have a young Vietnamese American group. We created it originally because we knew that there's a risk that we're going to be taken over by middle class, middle age professionals like me. And so we have to have leadership and thinking about the younger generation right from the get-go. It's not a second thought. And so we have a Young Vietnamese American Committee, Philip Nguyen, I think you know him, is one of the leaders of that. We want to make sure that that's connected very tightly to the Vietnamese Student Association. Again, we're not trying to push a particular policy. We're just trying to make sure that the right people are in the room when we're discussing the policies. We have a huge media team that works on social media. I think our social media approach is actually what's made us really well known. We've done a lot of different kind of work, but our reach on social media has actually helped us. We have a candidate support team, that committee that actually vet people, including Vietnamese American candidates. One of our most proud moments was within a few months of our founding, we helped Kathy Tran to get elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, the first Vietnamese American for sure in that state house. But we go down that path, and right now it's mostly volunteers and some consultants doing work. We are, just in case, I'll make a pitch. We're trying to hire our first executive director. So if you give us money, we'll be able to hire a really good executive director, and we'll be able to take our next step. So pivotnetwork.org.
Thank you for that pitch. What are some of the KPIs, or do you have any metrics that measure any type of success?
This is a really important question. And I tend to be this annoying philosopher person who always turn the question back on the questioner. Because actually, who asks the questions and what kind of questions they ask is actually the first measure of power. Okay. I flip this. We get this question asked a lot. And data is not cheap. Okay. For me to show that something worked, I have to collect data. I have a choice between spending money on collecting data or spending the money on doing the work. Okay, so I always flip it back to donors and I say, well, how do you know? Well, will you tell me how much money you're giving for this community? What percentage of your budget goes to this community? And they're like, well, either they won't know or they won't tell you. And I say, well, you can't ask me for accountability when you have no accountability. Right? And a Vietnamese person say, I want to join Pivot, and what have you done so I can give you my time? I mean, we will do our due diligence and give them what we've learned, but I would ask back, well, what have you given to the Vietnamese American community? Why are you asking me that question? What have you done? And if you haven't done anything, then why, you can't ask me a question that you can't live up to.
Right.
If all you do is sit at home and argue, fine, that's what you do. How much of an effect does it have on anything or anybody's lives? Well, it doesn't. So if you want to do something for your community, you don't have to join us. You can do something else, but go do something.
Yes.
Come back and ask me how we're doing, okay? I'm being a little bit more, aggressive than I mean to. We have done a lot of good stuff. I mean, number one, and then the other thing that's important is, and I emphasize this, and a lot of people don't get it. When they ask about outcomes, they're asking about hard outcomes. And I do health research, so I know what I'm talking about. They ask about hard outcomes, like how many people did you elect? How do you know that what you did helped that person get elected, right? That's the fundamental question about elections, right? Number one, no one actually knows that answer for any group. we claim things like, oh, the black voters in Georgia got this done, or the Asian voters. It's all inferred. It's not causal. And there is no study design that's going to get you there, okay? I know this. I do research for a living. But you can point to that, like, oh, we did get a lot of Asian votes out. We did get a lot of Vietnamese votes out, right? So those things you can point to. But the other thing that's really important is the biggest outcome isn't an election. It comes and it goes. And someone gets elected, and so they come and they go. And the most important outcome is capacity. Because if we fail as Pivot, then what will happen is that everything goes away, and the next generation will come in. They have to spend another 5 years building them up to do what it is that they want to do.
Right.
Okay. So I think actually capacity is way more important than any one particular project outcomes. And the fact that we even exist, the fact that every time something that happens with Vietnamese American people come to us, we've actually gotten grant money. People just come to us and give us money. They're like, oh, we want to work with Vietnamese American. Pivot's great. Even though this is not a topic you've been working on, we'll give you some money. We don't even go out and apply for grants anymore. I mean, we will. You know, we have a strategy for all that stuff. But right now, people are throwing money at us. That's the proof I want. The proof I want is they think we're powerful enough to give us resources to do the things that we want to do. Okay, they don't even demand that we do anything for them. They're just like, just work with the Vietnamese American community. You know, that to me is actually proof of power.
So it sounds a lot like optics. You know, I'm trying to figure out capacity and how, not necessarily how we can define capacity, but it sounds more broad, like optics is very important and vital to the mission.
Well, optics is okay, except I think the word tend to have a negative connotation. Like it's not substantial, okay? Perception is power. Perception is power. So that's one element. So yes, we want to tell people that we matter, okay? But you have to deliver. You can't, you know, at some point perception perception can't just become reality until you prove it, okay? But there's a Silicon Valley saying, you know, fake it till you make it, okay? I mean, hundreds of software companies have raised billions of dollars on the fake it till you make it.
Right.
Concept, right? But I don't want to talk about that necessarily. I want to talk about capacity. There's a classic saying, you can teach a man you can give a man a fish or you can teach him how to fish, okay? That's capacity, okay? Fishing gets you one meal. You know, learning how to, I mean, getting someone to fish gives them one meal. That's the outcome of the project, okay? That's project. Capacity is having the ability to know how to do this and the mechanisms and the structures to do this, right? And that's what we're after. I'm actually, you know, you can pick a particular policy issue and I'll tell you what I think, okay? But I will give it up within Pivot if someone else believes something else, if I think it's more important for me to build a capacity.
Oh, wow.
Than that. And people say that's compromising your principles. No, you're thinking about it the wrong way. What's the outcome? The outcome is not that this policy get done or that policy gets done. The outcome is, do we have an organization that can carry our communities forward? Okay.
Even if it's diametrically opposed to the way you feel and
see. No. That's why you have a mission and a vision. You don't let people in unless you agree on the mission and your vision. Okay. Right. But within that, there's a ton of arguments and a ton of positions you can take. And I'm actually much more interested in listening to the other person's point of view. And then, I mean, of course, if it's me and them, we could have a pitch battle. But usually there's a big group of people and then we have to like have a big discussion and then people come to some conclusion and resolution and consensus. And that's the part that actually is more interesting to me.
Yeah.
Like, how do we get the consensus when there are these diametrically opposite viewpoints within the same vision? Right.
You know, the idea for me when I see Pivot is it's in the name, progressive. And when people of a different stripe comes along and they see the branding, the word Pivot, and they see progressive and they've heard it for the last 5 years and they associate it with a certain type of brand, how do we get away from that sort of polarization? I hope I'm asking it in a way that's clear.
Well, I mean, the other side always takes anything that's moderate to left as communism. Let's just call it what it is, okay? They do that. Vietnam is Jamo, right? So Jamo, we're like pigeonholing people, you know? We don't buy into that narrative at all. We don't care. You can call us whatever you want. We're not gonna fight it. The generation that cares about communism and anti-communism is getting old. I'm just being frank here. And that's a battle that needs to be fought. I'm sure, you know, if we have to get into that battle, we'll fight that battle. But progressive is basically one thing to me, which is people matters. People matters more than ideology. People matters more than money. People matter more than anything. That's what progressive means to me. I mean, first of all, you know, a lot of people who are progressive say, you guys aren't progressive. I'm like, who are you to define what progressivism is? As a matter of fact, isn't progressivism about, you know, everybody's having their own concept of what's right? Progressivism is not socialism. I mean, you want to be a socialist, you can be a socialist. I don't care, you know, but it's not socialism. It's progressive. It's basically, to me, humanism in political form. Okay? That's what it means to me.
At the end of the day, is the person being taken care of in society?
Yeah. Are we, it's both actually, because I don't want to go too far into the individualism side of things. Like, again, the classic sort of problem you're seeing now is, you know, the COVID, the anti-COVID type people are like very individualistic, and the rest of us are like very communal, like that we take care of the community. It's about both the individual person and the group of people. Aren't they taken care of? It's both. It's not one or the other.
Now, that's a really interesting distinction, because the classification, I mean, these words matter, right? I mean, the individualized distinction versus the group distinction, I mean, there are so many different ways that we can approach that.
We're getting back to the zeros and ones again.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, the people think that there's individual right and there's community rights, okay? And I thought this going up, because in Vietnam, it was all community, and it sucked. Like, people would, like, put you... I mean, I was 10 years old, and I knew that was it sucked, because people were talking bad about people's back, behind people's back, for the choices they were making in their lives, you know? Having, like, live in that rigid community value way is no good. And I'm an individualist. I would never want to live that way. And then you come to the United States, and there's this huge individualism, like me, and I don't care about anybody else, right? And that's what basically a person who won't wear a mask is saying, me, and I don't care about anybody else, right? But hardly anyone lives like that. Even the person who's not wearing a mask has a community of people who don't want to wear masks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and a person who's all community is like, if my kid were like being beat upon because, you know, because they don't look the way, wear the same clothes everybody wears, I'm going to defend my kid, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all this stuff, you know? And it's all, every day we make these choices about our individual needs and our communal contributions. Every day. You do it, like, you go out there and you stop at the stop sign when there's no car coming across. Individually, you would have just gone right through it. But communally, you're like thinking, maybe it's a good thing not to go run the stop sign. You know, every day you make these decisions. And sometimes you go on one side, sometimes you go on the other side. It's the dynamic that matters. Again, back to the process, the dynamics.
You know, you have a very measured approach as you look out into the world and everything. There's grayscales and there's nuances to a lot of things. But that's not how our computer algorithms are being processed in the world. We are selected based on a couple clicks on our phones or mouses, and we get put into camps. Do you think that there is progress with our world today, despite the algorithm issue?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, actually. I hadn't really thought about that, but you're right. I mean, computers tend to do that, but actually that's a very rudimentary understanding of what computers and things do. In health research in particular, the one thing is there's a new idea called natural language processing, which allows you to figure things out more than just zeros and ones. So you can study the way people talk and the way people write and sort of figure out, you know, where they fit and things like that. But it is true that, you know, if you're monetizing technology, they're trying to get you into one group or another. But it turns out that, and then it is very dangerous in more than the way you think, because if I log onto a social media and they give me certain ads, it's not about one or two things that I've done, it's about all the things that I've done that got right. me to that ad, right? So the goal there is for you to be completely identify from zeros and ones. You're either this or that, but it's like a million things that are zeros and ones. So everybody has their own number now, right? So yeah. So that, and you know, in some way, that is the ultimate individualism, isn't it? I was just telling you about this whole communal versus individual. The whole point in the monetizings of social media is that everyone's an individual. They're going to find the sweet spot for you. They're going to deliver you exactly all the things you want that makes you different from everybody else, right? That's individualism. And that's why I'm not surprised that, you know, the rise of social media has caused fractionalization and division.
And it's creating all kinds of mental health issues.
Yes, it is. But we always say, we always had mental health issues. See? And we always had division. See, to me, you know, the older you get, the more you see things play out over and over again, and they just play out differently, just like your kids. Like your kids take, you know, certain things about you and they express it differently. You know,
so you don't sound very concerned. I mean, I'm extrapolating.
I'm not. Well, no. Remember, I'm a process person. I'm not an outcomes person. I am concerned. I am fighting. Okay, I do all that. I have to fight back. And again, just because I see the pattern doesn't mean that somehow I will let it happen. You know, that's right. Actually what empowerment is about, right? But it ebbs and flows. I'm not apocalyptic. Okay. The difference between what I'm saying, what everybody else is saying, is that, oh, this is the end of the world. And I'm like, no, it's happened before, and it just takes a different form, and maybe a different magnitude even. But except for climate change, nothing's apocalyptic.
You know? Right.
So take the technology, and I mean, again, you know, there's been a huge pendulum swing, and I think what we're seeing is that the corporations and sort of the centralization of power and money is bad, and it hasn't swung back, okay? And that's one of the things that I think we're seeing. And that's what's causing a lot of these problems, I think. Here's the thing, like, okay, I'll take an example with COVID, right? So right now, you know, about 75% of the people have gotten vaccinated against COVID, and about another 10% of people are not sure, and 15% of people are like completely against the vaccine, right? And people are like, wow, you know, as a doctor, if I can get 75% of people to do anything, mm-hmm. I'm happy.
Yeah.
Right? Smokers, right? You know, smoking's bad, right? Like, who doesn't know smoking's terrible? And it's just kind of like COVID. You give cancer to other people when you breathe on them, right? So it's not like COVID, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, there's a communal aspect to the behavior. 10 to 15% of people still smoke. We have great treatment. We have great therapy. We have blah, 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 blah. You know, they do. If I ask you a question about anything, there's going to be 10% of the people right. who don't agree. That's how human nature is. That's the zeros and ones, you know. And so, you know, in the big picture, not in the little, in the current picture, you have to fight against COVID misinformation. You got to promote vaccines. You have to figure out different ways of working with that 15%. Because I actually, you know, in health, in people who do health education understand something very important, which is they are individuals. Each person who's anti-vax is different from the other person who's anti-vax. Some of them are anti-vax for this reason, some of them are anti-vax for this reason. Some of them are anti-vax absolutely, and some of them are just a little anti-vax. And for each of those person, there's a message that you can work on. And for the person who's closer to the vax, it'll go quicker. And for the person way on this side, it'll go longer, okay?
It seems like every issue in society can be looked at from that sort of perspective. I mean, take, for example, I have a lot of friends and family in one camp, anti-BLM, and they look at the Stop Asian Hate, and they're always asking me, well, why can't you point out the fact that, you know, it's people of color doing that to our Asian. And why isn't that ever? So there's all these degrees, but how do we make sense of it since the polarization in social media is just so effective?
Again, I'm going back to the simple and the complex, okay? Simple explanations are easier to accept and follow.
Yes.
Complex explanations are much harder to explain and incorporate. So the difference between anti-Asian hate caused by some people of color, it's a simple explanation. The hard explanation is, why is this happening? What are the structures in place that make this happen, right? And you can go down that path. You know, maybe it's more likely that some people of color are doing this because they are, you know, whatever explanation it is, you know, it's, you know, they're poor or they don't have jobs and they get angry, you know, or they have mental health problems that are not being treated adequately by the system. These people of color are in this place because of a certain amount of structural issues that put them there, okay? And so when you see this happening, you have to understand that if you just, all you do is fight back against a person of color, yeah. You haven't solved anything. As a matter of fact, you also hurt yourself, right? Because this is very clear. So talk about defund the police, right? So, you know, for a lot of black activists, defund the police is the key, right? Because they are being incarcerated, they are being killed by police. If I were a black person, I'd be like, yeah, the police is the enemy. The Asian person is like, our safety is in question here. Yeah, we need more police to protect us, right? Both positions are completely valid. But the solution isn't to say, well, we don't like the black people and we don't like the Asian people. The question is, what is the real role of the police? Okay? Right? Because truly, really, no one do want to defund the police, like no police at all, right? But can we have a police system where they're not killing black people and protecting Asian people? Why aren't we asking that question? Why can't we have a police system where they don't kill black people and they protect all the Asian people? What's wrong with that? That's what they're supposed to do. Not kill innocent people and protect innocent people. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We cannot give that conversation to someone else, because everyone who's in there going, well, you know, Asian people should be, you know, fighting against this thing, against other people of color, they're not there because they care about Asian people. They are there because of the ideology.
Absolutely.
Okay. So don't buy into that, but we do need a good, reasonable response. I can't be there and say, well, oh, you know, yeah, it's very complicated. I don't have a solution. My solution is, why can't we have a conversation with the police, protect innocent people, and don't kill them, whatever color they are?
Yeah. Thank you so much today. I walk out of this episode feeling more hopeful that the ability for us to have dialogue and get down to the nuances is almost everything. It's so important these days to have long form conversations for people like me who, you know, I don't really get it and I don't really understand it. And to have somebody like you explain it to me. And I think explaining it once, it's still not enough. I'm going to be processing this and probably asking you to come back on again soon to explain more things to me.
Well, thanks for having me on. This has been great. No one ever sit and listen to me for an hour and a half before. So this is good. But I will say this. You asked me what it means to be Vietnamese American. Imagine yourself on a barge in the middle of the ocean. A barge. A barge that doesn't have an engine. Okay? That's where I was. And imagine yourself now me. Okay? That's a hopeless situation that had a good outcome. So to me, hope, you have to be hopeful. And it is a fundamental nature of Vietnamese American to be hopeful. Don't despair. People who despair end up doing bad things. To be very kind to all the anti-communist Vietnamese out there, they despaired. They despaired. They didn't look at hope. Mm. They didn't see the world as hopeful. And which is weird, because they survive all these terrible things to be here, yeah, and be alive and have their kids go to school. And for some reason, they focus on the past and the despair of the past and not on the hope for the present and the future. And that's what it means for me to be Vietnamese American, is to stay focused on the present and the future and to make sure that everyone has a voice in the present and the future.
And what you brought up earlier and throughout the whole episode about that condition of picking, you know, there's a real problem in your, you know, your life, your working life, not making enough money. And then there's this other far away issue that you can focus on and relieve yourself almost of the pain.
Yep. Yep. They're both despairing conditions.
Yes.
But one is much more proximal and one's much farther. And you can hope that somehow the regime in Vietnam is going to change. And it's easier to deal with that than to hope that your life here is going to change. But they both should be hopeful things. I'm privileged. Okay, I'll be very honest. I'm very privileged. I live a good life. I have a lot of control over my own destiny. So I could be very naive about this. But having been in a place where I wasn't privileged, I think hope is the way. And then you go back to the whole conversation about religion and Catholicism and all this stuff. It's hope. It is not control. It's hope. And that's what it means to be Vietnamese American.
Thank you so much, Anh Tung. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.